This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Tennis star Naomi Osaka out of the French Open, citing mental health concerns. Today, many athletes are lining up behind her.
As an athlete, you're kind of considered to be this almost like Roman gladiator, but that's not the world. You're a human being just like everyone else.
Also today, some scientists were unable to travel to the North and South Poles during the pandemic. Now they're worried about neglected research stations.
There is the risk that a window gets broken by wind or polar bears or something else.
I'm Marco Werman, and a museum has gifted the archives of Stephen Hawking, even his cartoon version.
Your theory of a donut-shaped universe is intriguing, Homer. I may have to steal it.
Wow, I can't believe someone I never heard of is hanging out with a guy like me.
All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It is good to be back with you. The sports world is still processing the news. Japanese tennis superstar Naomi Osaka's decision last night in Paris to withdraw from the French Open. Entering the tournament, the 23-year-old said she would opt out of press conferences to protect her mental health. When tournament organizers pushed back, the star walked away. As the world's Bianca Hillier reports, Osaka's decision has sparked a new conversation among athletes.
When Osaka announced her plans to skip post-match interviews, players from a variety of sports and nationalities hailed her courage to speak up. But not everyone said they'd make the same call. Spain's Rafael Nadal was among those who said speaking to the media is part of the job.
I understand her, but on the other hand, for me, without the press, without the people who normally are writing the news and the achievements that we are having around the world, probably we will not be the athletes that we are today, and we will not be that popular.
Professional athletes, including Osaka, are contractually obligated to speak to members of the press. But as she promised, Osaka skipped the post-game press conference after winning Sunday's first-round match.
Naomi Osaka lets her racket do the talking and wins her Paris opener.
The move brought her a $15,000 fine and a threat from the four Grand Slam tournaments. They said if she kept it up, she'd face bigger fines and possibly be kicked off the court altogether. Osaka didn't wait for them to make the call.
Naomi Osaka just announced that she has withdrawn from Roland Garros this year.
Osaka said on social media that she has suffered long bouts of depression since the U.S. Open in 2018, when the crowd booed her for defeating fan favorite Serena Williams.
Good evening, everyone, and we welcome you to the trophy celebration of the United States Open.
Williams stood up for Osaka in that moment.
Congratulations, Naomi! No more booing!
And continued to support her this week.
I feel for Naomi. I feel like I wish I could give her a hug because I know what it's like. Like I said, I've been in those positions.
In her statement, Osaka said she never wanted to be a distraction from the tournament.
Osaka writes that she is going to take some time away from the court and she wants to talk with tour officials about ways to make things better for players, for press, and for fans as well.
The Women's Tennis Association, or WTA, said it would welcome dialogue with Naomi to discuss possible approaches regarding mental health concerns. French Tennis Federation President Gilles Moreton spoke to the press after Osaka's announcement.
We are sorry and sad for Naomi Osaka. We wish her the best and the quickest possible recovery. And we look forward to having Naomi in our tournament next year.
Moreton continued to say that all of the Grand Slams are committed to improving athletes' experiences in their tournaments, including with the media. Neither the WTA nor the Federation replied to my request for comment on how they will do so. But Daria Abramovic has a few ideas.
I think that there is a lot to do in terms of education.
Abramovic is a sports psychologist. She's at the French Open right now to support 20-year-old Polish pro Iga Świątek. Most athletes don't travel with a mental health specialist, but she believes more of them should. Abramovic says, as a leading figure in tennis, Osaka's withdrawal could be a game changer in terms of prioritizing mental health.
An athlete is, first of all, a human being.
Former NFL player Chris Cluey agrees.
As an athlete, you're kind of considered to be this almost like Roman gladiator, right? Where you're in this arena and it's like anything goes because you're there for entertainment. But that's not the world. Like, once you step away from whatever playing surface it is you play on, you're a human being just like everyone else.
Cluey thinks there should be a cooling off period between the end of play and press conferences to allow athletes to compose themselves after hours of work and pressure. He also pointed out that if an athlete was physically injured, no one would question skipping post-game interviews.
But if I, as an NFL player, went out there and had a really bad day and my mental processes were not in the same spot as they were before, everyone would be like, oh, you need to tough it out. But the thing is, like, your brain is just as much a part of your body as your knee or your hamstring or your ribs.
Former pro basketball player Rod Benson says mental health was not talked about when he competed in the U.S. and South Korea.
Literally never. This is why Naomi's blowing up, because this is a new conversation.
A new conversation. And, he says, a unique moment to redefine what greatness in sports is.
If our old conception is winning the most makes you the greatest, our new conception should be like winning, but winning in all aspects of life, winning for yourself, I think will be the new definition of what greatness is.
Benson applauds top-ranking Osaka for initiating this global conversation, for staying true to herself, and for hopefully helping other athletes to do the same. For the World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
In President Biden's defense budget, he's got two big priorities: keeping China at bay and giving U.S. troops a raise. To do that, the number he's proposing to spend on the Pentagon, $715 billion. Next stop, Congress and some heated debate. Michael O'Hanlon has been reading through Biden's proposed budget, and he joins us now from the Brookings Institution in Washington. Michael, $715 billion. How does it compare with recent Pentagon budgets?
It's about $10 billion more than the 2021 budget, the one we're operating off now, which was essentially Trump's last budget. And that $10 billion is basically enough to keep up with inflation. So in the simplest sense of the word, this is about as flat of an extrapolation as you're going to get. And you mentioned $715 billion, which is correct for the Department of Defense. But when you add in other national defense functions, most importantly, the nuclear weapons activities at the Department of Energy, you could also say it's a $752 billion budget.
So what can you say generally about what that money, that $715 billion, is going to do? I mean, is the Pentagon basically going to stick to current hardware and spending schemes, or are there any major pivots to new types of spending?
I think the simplest way to answer that is to say that in terms of what we're buying and building, the changes are not dramatic. If you're looking for big change, it's going to be still in the future in the research, development, test, and evaluation accounts, which are very large, more than $100 billion for innovation, essentially. But that's targeting future systems that we're not yet buying and deploying.
So when it comes to that R&D budget, what kind of future systems are you imagining, or do you actually know of things that are in the works?
You're talking about everything from smaller satellites that could be survivable even against direct attack, or at least too numerous to bring down en masse. It could be more offensive weapons like so-called hypersonics that travel at the speed of, you know, ICBMs today, but carry conventional weapons and can be used in more tactical settings. Certainly involves a lot of investment in the cyber world and artificial intelligence. To some extent, we're talking about the next generation bomber, the B-21. We're talking about unmanned systems for ground vehicles, undersea vehicles, other ships, and for aircraft. You know, the innovations really cover the gamut.
Yeah, thinking about the future, I mean, you mentioned taking out tiny U.S. satellites in space. I mean, that's not something the average country could pull off. What country does the Pentagon see as potentially doing that, taking out U.S. satellites?
Well, there's no doubt that it's largely focused on China and Russia. And in fact, some people, like my good friend Michelle Flournoy, who's written an excellent article in Foreign Affairs, reinforce the importance of continuing to accelerate our innovation. And while I agree with that, I also don't want us to overdo the focus on China and Russia and leave out concerns in places like Korea or the Middle East. And I think we need a balanced set of capabilities, given that we have 50 or 60 allies around the world, most of which are important to our security. And therefore, since they face different threat environments, we want to be with them with a range of tools and capabilities ourselves.
It feels like once a month we hear about some hack coming from China or Russia. Where is Cyber Command in this budget? Is the threat from hackers like Cozy Bear factored in?
You know, that's an excellent question. And it may actually be our number one vulnerability, that not only the cyber of the Department of Defense, which at least is protected by Cyber Command, but the cyber capabilities that support our national infrastructure, which is not owned by the Department of Defense or often even the government, but is essential for military operations because we use the trains and airfields and ports and other parts of our national infrastructure to send military deployments and reinforcements overseas. So I think that it's actually not just Cyber Command, but I would want to see more emphasis here on a whole of government and whole of private sector strategy for protecting our cyber systems from hostile attack. That piece, I believe, is missing in this budget.
So how does President Biden's Pentagon budget factor into his foreign policy, Michael? What do traditional allies see and what do potential enemies see?
I think it's a good budget overall because, again, it sustains the real level, the inflation-adjusted level of military spending after a Trump buildup that was pretty substantial. So I think if we can stay steady in this range that you mentioned earlier, $750 billion for national defense, $715 billion for the Pentagon's part, that's pretty good, especially if we then beef up the role of the State Department and Treasury in overall strategies for what Secretary Austin calls integrated deterrence, deterrence that involves especially our economic instruments of national power as well as our diplomatic ones.
Michael O'Hanlon with the Brookings Institution in Washington. He's the author of The Art of War in an Age of Peace. Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you kindly.
In a country like Yemen, where years of civil war have devastated the country, good news is a rare commodity. But there was some good news, great news for some fishermen and their village. These Yemeni fishermen recently struck gold inside of a dead whale. The whale's corpse contained ambergris. Colloquially, we're talking whale vomit, which is rare and valuable. The fishermen managed to sell their catch for $1.5 million and reportedly plan on sharing that with their village. So just what is ambergris? Chris Kemp is a scientist, ambergris expert, and author of Floating Gold. So help us out here, Chris, because people have described ambergris as whale vomit. You say it's more like whale poop. What is it?
It is whale poop. Well, it's actually a very specialized kind of pathological whale poop. But yes, it definitely comes out the same place as poop.
So if it's whale pooped, I mean, when it's retrieved from a whale carcass, from a sperm whale carcass, what does it look like? What does it smell like?
Well, it's going to be, I mean, so this is sort of another aspect of the life of ambergris. Typically, ambergris needs to be released into the ocean by a dead whale, sort of decomposing enough to release it. And then it needs to float around sort of in the ocean currents for years, perhaps even decades, perhaps even longer than that.
Such a strange commodity, whale poop, and yet it has this incredible value.
Yeah, and a rich history with humanity going back for centuries. 500 years ago, if you were a wealthy king and you had a child, you might receive a big block of ambergris as a celebratory gift from another monarch somewhere else.
What exactly is it used for? Where does it get its value?
Most typically, its most common use is in perfumes. Some centuries ago, one of those really strange discoveries was made. Someone determined that this ambergris, when you sort of turn it into a tincture and add it to fragrance, that's its purpose. Basically, it stabilizes the fragrance and keeps it around for a long time.
Wow. So perfumes that last a long time just have more sperm whale poop in them, most likely?
Yeah. Perfumers call it animalic. It's very sort of musky and sort of stinky in that way that you can't really determine whether it's pleasant or not. Somewhere these base notes are sort of really musky and stinky and a little bit sort of threatening and unsettling. And that's what ambergris brings to a good perfume.
Do all whales have ambergris in their bodies or just sperm whales?
It's just sperm whales. And even then, it's really the product of a very sick and uncomfortable sperm whale. It's really a sign that the animal has indigestion and isn't doing so well. That's one of those factors that really add to its scarcity and value.
Chris Kemp is a scientist and author of Floating Gold about ambergris. Chris, thanks very much for coming on the show.
You're so welcome.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Mars is called the Red Planet for good reason. Just about every inch of it is red. But NASA's Mars Curiosity rover captured some other colors from Mars this week. Light pinks, blues, and greens, almost shining like diamonds in the sky. Joining me to discuss the rover's latest snapshots is Ashwin Vasavada, lead scientist of the Curiosity Mars rover mission at NASA. So I've seen some of these photos, and to an untrained eye, the colors are shiny and pretty. Can you describe these pictures, what we are in fact seeing, and what is special about this?
We were just blown away by these beautiful pictures of clouds on Mars. Just for background, the sky on Mars is really nothing to write home about usually. It's just usually a pink void that we see above all the beautiful geology. But lately we've been seeing these incredibly beautiful shimmering clouds, wispy clouds with all these different colors in them.
What are Mars's clouds made of? Why are they so colorful?
Yeah, they're colorful because they're thin and they have a lot of ice particles that are rapidly growing and kind of the same size. And this creates an effect almost like when you see like a rainbow film on an oil spill on the ground, something like that. It's just a neat optical phenomena that makes these otherwise clear ice particles turn into a rainbow of colors.
So what do those ice particles tell us? I mean, that suggests there's water, right?
These clouds are either made of water ice or they're made of carbon dioxide ice. They may be so high in Mars' atmosphere that it's cold enough for carbon dioxide itself to freeze, forming clouds.
What can these photos teach us about Mars, Ashwin?
Well, you know, other than just how beautiful they are, and it's so nice to have something above the rocks to look at, they teach us about Mars' climate. Just like on Earth, the clouds play a really important role in regulating the climate of Mars. And by understanding how and when water and carbon dioxide ice clouds form, we can understand the climate not only today, but in the distant past when Mars may have had a lot more water.
What can you extrapolate about climate on Earth based on what you're seeing in these pictures?
Well, you know, clouds are a really important regulator of the climate on Earth. So one of the things that we really learn from studying other planets is they are natural comparisons to the same kind of physics that we see on Earth, just different laboratories for the same experiment.
So as lead scientists of the Curiosity mission, you probably spent a lot of time thinking about Mars. How does it feel to see these photos for the first time?
They're just really fascinating to look at. And, you know, with Curiosity having been on the surface now for 8.5 years, sometimes you think we may have found all the new things that we'll ever find, but we're continually surprised by what Mars has to offer. And this was just kind of a fluke. We weren't expecting these clouds. We had never seen them before, but we looked up after sunset one day and they were there, and we're just enjoying learning about them.
Ashwin, a lot of people have been hearing about the Perseverance rover that landed on Mars this year, but these photos we're talking about, they came from Curiosity, which, as you said, has been on Mars for almost 9 years. Are you hoping these photos remind the world that Curiosity's still got it?
Absolutely. You know, Mars did us a real favor by allowing us to discover these clouds and have something to wave around while Perseverance is getting all the attention.
How close are Perseverance and Curiosity? I mean, there's no chance of any moving violations on Mars, right?
No, they're pretty far apart, several thousand miles, I believe. Far enough where they might not even see the same kinds of clouds where they're at. We're near the equator where these clouds tend to form.
Yeah, this is an exclusive for Curiosity.
Absolutely. You heard it here first.
Ashwin Vasavada is the lead scientist of the Curiosity Mars rover mission at NASA. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Stephen Hawking was a groundbreaking theoretical physicist renowned for his work on black holes. Beyond his brilliant mind, Hawking is also known for overcoming adversity. He was diagnosed with a motor neuron disease at age 22 and given just a few years to live. But Hawking beat the odds and lived to 76. He used a wheelchair and speech synthesizers to communicate. The full scope of Hawking's work will be given to the Cambridge University Library and the Science Museum, both in the UK. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with the librarian at Cambridge, Jessica Gardner.
I'm absolutely thrilled that the Stephen Hawking Archive is coming to the University Library of Cambridge. You don't get many of these in a career, and this is an absolute career highlight for me. Of course, we already house the archives of Isaac Newton, Charles Darwin. So this completes the trinity with Stephen Hawking of three of the Cambridge scientists, perhaps the best known scientists in the world, who've changed how we understand our place in the universe. It's hard to express how much I'm smiling at the moment.
I'd love to ask you about some of the more unusual items in the collection, like when he was on The Simpsons.
Your theory of a donut-shaped universe is intriguing, Homer. I may have to steal it.
Wow, I can't believe someone I never heard of is hanging out with a guy like me.
Tell me about the television scripts you've collected.
That is such a hilarious episode of The Simpsons, isn't it? The script actually doesn't contain that wonderful line about the donut-shaped universe. So we don't know yet. We'd love to find out more if anyone knows whether that was ad-lib or put in later, or even if Stephen Hawking introduced the line himself. But the scripts include from The Simpsons, from Star Trek, from Futurama, and of course, Stephen Hawking's personal script from The Theory of Everything, where he was portrayed so wonderfully, beautifully by Eddie Redmayne, with that cheeky smile that people remember Stephen Hawking having himself.
What's one of your favourite items from the archive?
There are so many and so many more to find, but let me pick out one letter. This is from 1964, and it's actually from his PhD supervisor when he was at Cambridge in the early part of his studies. Now, he was just 22 at the minute and had been diagnosed, obviously, recently with motor neuron disease. This is from his PhD supervisor to his father, Frank Hawking. And it's one of those letters that it must have been just a joy to receive as a parent. It's a glowing testimonial celebrating the work that Hawking is undertaking as a doctoral student. And its concluding lines, you know, talk about what a pleasure it is to teach him. And it goes on to say, remember, this is his professor. It goes on to say, indeed, we've reached a point where he is teaching me. And I think this is why archives matter. They give you the inside track and the turning points, in this case, in a scientific life.
So Cambridge University will hold Hawking's papers. And I understand the Science Museum in the UK will reconstruct his office for display, including his wheelchairs. Can you tell us about that?
We are absolutely delighted that the Science Museum will hold the artifacts from his office. And they are, as you say, going to recreate that. So it really is a collection that, when it's displayed in the Science Museum, will help to tell not only his scientific story, but, you know, how he worked physically and the technological innovations. We use things like voice activation now through all the media and phones that we use in a very common way. But of course, it was groundbreaking at the time. And so he would be one of the early adopters testing things and feeding back to companies that were developing those kind of tools.
Will the papers be available online for scholars or the general public to access?
So our commitment is to make this as widely available as possible. We know that Stephen Hawking was, you know, beloved, not just in Cambridge, not just in the UK, but absolutely around the world. And so that is our commitment. It'll take us a bit of time, and we will fundraise to help with our efforts. But we will bring as soon as possible parts of it to the much wider knowledge of the world. So it's at your fingertips of your computer. We actually published his PhD thesis online, openly and freely available to our digital library in 2017. And that went on to break the servers of our library because millions around the world wanted to access it. So we know there's a thirst, and the real pleasure of being the forever home of this archive is that we can begin to open it up and share those highlights with everybody around the world.
That was Jessica Gardner, librarian at the University of Cambridge, speaking with my colleague, Carol Hills. This is The World. Sweden used to have a low rate of gang violence and gun crime. In less than a decade, that's changed for the worse. Police say gang members themselves want out.
They're wearing bulletproof vests every day. They're afraid. They can't sleep. They can't trust anyone.
How Sweden is tackling gun violence, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Chinese families may be getting a little bigger. The ruling Communist Party is now allowing couples to have three children. That's up from two. And just 6 years ago, it was the one-child policy that ruled. Yesterday's announcement caused a huge reaction in China. But as The World's Rebecca Canther reports from Shanghai, not the reaction you'd expect.
Christina Wang's reaction probably wasn't what the government was hoping for. We all thought it was a joke, she says. It was so funny, so unbelievable. Nobody took it seriously. After the announcement, the internet exploded with jokes. She picks up her phone to read me one. Here's one that everyone is laughing about, she says. Four aging parents to support, three kids to raise, the couple will just die under the pressure. I guess it sounds funnier in Chinese. Christina is a teacher, and she and her husband love kids. 9 years ago, before the government allowed couples to have more than one child, she quit her university job and angered her parents by having a second child illegally. But one more? She says she's good. I certainly won't be having a third child, she says. Even if I was 10 years younger, I wouldn't consider it. Wang's not alone. Right after the news was released yesterday afternoon, the state news service Xinhua put out an online poll. Within an hour, the response was overwhelming. 23,000 people said they didn't want a third child. 1,200 said they did. The poll was abruptly taken offline, and the comments section removed. Ashley Fu thought that was hilarious. She's a new mom in Shanghai. Her six-month-old daughter is waking six or seven times a night, and she's exhausted. She recently quit her corporate job because of lack of sleep. Her husband wants a second child, but Fu says that will be a stretch.
I don't think the policy is for people like me. I just feel it's for whoever who needed the policy, the super rich people or people live in a village or something, but not for people like me.
For people in the village, in other words, rural areas, another child is an extra pair of hands. But most people live in cities now, and having children is expensive. Jiang Tian is a stay-at-home dad in Shanghai. He has two kids. I don't even want to think about having a third child, he says. Two kids are already taking up my whole life. How can I even consider a third? Time, experience, energy, mental capacity, finances. I'm maxed out on all of these, he says. All of this is a huge problem for China. It has the largest population in the world, but the latest census showed it now has the lowest birth rate in decades. That means its population is aging and its workforce shrinking. The government tried to correct the sliding birth rate by allowing everyone two kids, but by then it was too late. An entire generation of only children were simply not interested in having a second child. With marriage rates also dropping, even one child is a stretch for some. Iris Pang is an economist studying China. She says the government is extremely worried.
They may also think that this is not the best solution to increase the population. But for now, this is the quick solution.
It doesn't matter how many kids the government allows, she says.
It's not about the number. It is about the monetary resources and the time resources to raise a child.
Young people are being pragmatic, she says. If they were raised without siblings and married another only child, they're probably already worried about time and money. They know they'll be taking care of their aging parents, raising their own kids, and then helping out with their grandkids. Jane Zhang grew up in rural Ningxia, but now lives in Shanghai with her husband and one-year-old son. She says at home, most of her friends and family have two or three kids. It's very normal. But she's not considering another child yet. The pace of life is much faster here in Shanghai, and the cost of living is so high. You need a lot of resources, so a second child would be much more expensive. Christina Wang, the teacher with two children, says the new policy fails to take those expenses into consideration. It's like the number of young people is decreasing, the factories don't have enough workers, so you need to be more patriotic and have more kids, she says. It's just not fair. Even in smaller cities, she says, parents need financial support to help with childcare, schooling, and the apartment costs that come along with having a larger family. Jiang Tian, the work-from-home dad, says pure patriotism isn't enough to sway him. He says, let the people with financial resources be patriotic then. The rest of us can be patriotic in other ways. Unless the government gives us something in return. How about some extra points on the college entrance exam for having a third child? Then maybe I'd think differently. If you don't give us help and just ask us to be patriotic, I don't think anyone's going to be that selfless, he says. These days, young people are focusing more on themselves, says economist Iris Pang.
For the urban population, especially the middle-income class, they are more reluctant to have children, not even one.
Like 29-year-old Jovial Zhou. She's single and works as a maternity nurse in Shanghai. when I ask her how many kids she plans to have, she doesn't even skip a beat.
No, zero.
She doesn't care about the pressure from her parents.
Because only I have one chance to be myself. So for now, I don't want to have kids to wasting my time. But some people will think this sounds is very selfish. But sorry, this is my decision.
Many people feel that it always should have been their decision. The government may now find out that they could keep people from having children, but they can't make people have more. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
That's it. You're in a timeout. Every parent knows what I'm talking about. We can all thank Arthur Stotz for this disciplinary technique. The inventor of the timeout died recently at the age of 97. To discuss the timeout, the benefits and shortcomings, we're joined by Professor Kate Ellis-Davies. She's a lecturer in psychology at Swansea University in Wales, where she studies the psychology of parenting and child development. Kate, when it comes to the timeout, what is the history of it and just how widespread is it?
So the history of it is that it really comes from this tradition of reinforcement, thinking about ways that we can entice behaviour that we're after and ways that we can discourage behaviour that we're not fond of, we're not searching for. And it comes from this kind of behaviourism side of psychology, which has been really used not just in children or parenting, but it's actually a very widely used area of psychology. And when we think about how widespread it is, a 2017 study actually found that of all the parents they surveyed, 77% of parents reported using timeout. So it's a fairly common procedure used within disciplining of children, especially in the West.
And I don't know where that survey was conducted, but would you find parents in India and Argentina and China all using it?
So that's an interesting question about how widespread it is globally. And one of the issues we have in psychology is actually we have a real bias towards psychology being studied in America, North America, and in Europe and in Australia. We have less comparative studies in different places, but definitely we see cultural variation in the forms of discipline that's used and how it's used as well. So in that same study that was used in 2017, actually that was a study that we found over 85% of parents that did use timeout used it incorrectly. So not only is there variation in whether it's used, there's definitely lots of variation in how it's used.
Right. So is there kind of like a baseline in how to use a timeout?
It's a package. So we often think about timeout as only being that negative component. So withdrawing the kind of social attention or the physical objects that children are drawn towards and thinking that that's the main part of the disciplining approach. But actually, from the very beginning, it was envisaged as of a paired component. So pairing with time in. So having lots of social attention, lots of encouragement, lots of praise, lots of explanation for what rules there are or what boundaries they're being set before you get to the point of timeout. And when we think about durations of it, the research tends to suggest that kind of 2 minutes be the duration of it. And that's definitely varies in how parents use it. Or they might give repeated warning over warning over warning before they go into timeout, and that's been shown to be less effective. Or they might put child in timeout, but actually there's lots of stimulation going on already. And that really hampers a child's ability to try and calm themselves down, try and help to self-regulate.
So it's been roundly supported, the timeout, as a discipline tool, but there are still some naysayers. What do they say?
Absolutely. I mean, there definitely is a lot of contention around this still. General mental health theories that really might be worried about actually what might this approach do to someone who is already vulnerable. So particularly the contraindications would be anyone with a trauma history or insecure attachment style to their parent or caregiver already, putting more pressure on that person's resilience to deal with that withdrawing of social attention, for example.
Kate, what situations do you use a timeout in, ever?
I have to say that I have not used timeout myself personally yet. I have two toddler twins. And if I was to use the timeout approach on my twins now, they wouldn't understand what was going on. They wouldn't understand why I was withdrawing with them. So they would just be distressing them. It wouldn't be kind of calming them down in the slightest. So I would say I haven't used it. We'll see, I guess, how things progress. I think it's an interesting consideration because when this approach came in, it was viewed as an alternative to physically punishing children, to corporal punishment. And so in contrast to physical punishment of children, this perspective on discipline came in to try and use psychology as a way of finding an alternative to disciplining children that did not involve physically harming children. There are lots of alternatives to the timeout approach, but I think it's important to put it in that historical context as well.
Professor Kate Ellis-Davies, a psychology lecturer at Swansea University in Wales, where she studies the psychology of parenting and child development, speaking with us about the time out. Kate, thank you very much.
Thank you.
A newly discovered frog species comes with a sweet name. Australian scientists named it chocolate frog, much to the delight of Harry Potter fans. It's a thing in Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. You can read more about the non-fictional chocolate frog in our newsletter. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Sweden used to have one of the lowest rates of gun violence in Europe. Now it has one of the highest. Remarkably, that change has taken place in less than a decade. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has more on how it happened.
Glenn Hjelgren has been a police officer in Malmö in southern Sweden for more than 40 years. And he's seen a lot. But a new report by Sweden's National Council for Crime Prevention that puts the country ahead of most of Europe for gun violence has taken him aback.
I was surprised in all of Europe. I thought maybe sixth or seventh place.
Gang wars and drugs are at the heart of the rise in gun crime, according to the report. This doesn't surprise Hjelgren. He's watched how gangs operate in Malmö for years, and he says there's a simple reason why young people join up.
Because they have nothing to do. If you're not working, you're not going to school, you will be hanging on the streets, and this group will just take, come with me and sell some drugs and you will earn some money. We have girls, fast cars and so on.
Gun ownership in Sweden is much lower than in the US, and the laws around owning one are strict. But Swedish crime analyst Bjorn Wegner says it's mostly illegal weapons that gang members get their hands on, and they seem increasingly willing to use them.
The bar for using a gun has been lowered compared to how it was previously, and this changed norm among criminals has led to a higher amount of shootings.
What Wegner doesn't know is why gangs in Sweden are resorting to guns more than in most other EU countries. Swedish economist Tino Sanandaji has his own theory.
It's due to immigration. Yesterday, we had one of the chiefs of police in one of our regions have a long article saying that in his experience, virtually all of these gang murders were done by immigrants, and in particular immigrants from certain countries that have a culture of macho violence.
Sanandaji says people in Sweden need to talk about the problems created by a relaxed immigration system. Former Prime Minister Carl Bildt once called the country a humanitarian superpower. During the 2015 migrant crisis, Sweden took in more refugees per capita than any other EU state. Sanandaji's views are somewhat surprising, given his own background. He emigrated to Sweden from Iran at the age of 9. I ask him if his own family didn't benefit from Sweden's generous welfare model.
Yeah, of course we did. I mean, that's not an argument. It doesn't matter if I personally benefited from it or didn't. But I've always said I would not have argued for Sweden taking me as a migrant. We didn't have any danger to our life. So it's a typical example of economic migration.
Sanandaji says if Sweden wants to deal with gun crime, it needs to tighten its immigration rules. But in the last 5 years, the country has changed those laws. And to some, it appears that Sweden is failing to live up to its humanitarian ideals.
Now it's horrible. No, I shouldn't say horrible, but it's very hostile against immigrants.
Anders Hellström is a lecturer at the Migration Research Institute at Malmö University. He says Sweden has long had a reputation for being welcoming to migrants and refugees. But in the last few years, he says, the message has changed.
Don't come here. And if you go here, don't stay. Go home. You do not belong here.
Right-wing foreign leaders have even pointed to Sweden to promote their own anti-immigrant views. Here's President Trump in 2017.
You look at what's happening last night in Sweden. Sweden. Who would believe this? Sweden. They took in large numbers. They're having problems like they never thought possible.
In fact, nothing had happened in Sweden the night before. And comments like this frustrate migration experts like Anders Hellström.
I cannot speak for all the people, but I was myself irritated. And I think that was a very one-dimensional view, right? It's simply not true. People feel safer these days.
And this is true for cities like Malmö. Police officers like Glenn Hjelgren said they were at the end of their rope trying to deal with fatal shootings in the city. So in 2018, they turn to a last resort, a strategy used in American cities like Boston, called group violence intervention. The idea is that the police target one member of a criminal gang, someone who's already done prison time. With the help of probation officers, they require that the gang member meets with key members of the community. And Quellgren says they give them a clear message.
We don't want you to die, and we don't want you to kill anyone. And the second one is, if you or anyone in your group shoots, blow something up, or kill anyone, it will have consequences for all of your group immediately. And the third message is, if you want to leave your criminal life, we will do everything we can to help you.
Quellgren was not convinced the strategy would work. Sweden is not America, he says. But 3 years on, and the shootings in Malmö have plummeted. The city also got additional police officers, which might have helped. But Quellgren says many gang members he's spoken to say they just want out.
More than half of them says, I'm so tired of this life. They're wearing bulletproof vests every day. They're afraid. They can't sleep. They can't trust anyone. So they say, oh, please help me out of this.
The programme has now been extended in Malmö for another 3 years. Glenn Quellgren says he'd love to see it expanded to other Swedish cities like Stockholm and Gothenburg. After all, he says, what have they got to lose? For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
It was a year of cancelled trips. Disappointing to miss out on your travel plans and dreams. For scientists doing fieldwork, though, being stuck at home was a much bigger deal. Many of them are still stuck at home at a time when they need to travel most. The World's Carolyn Beeler has our story.
Last September, geologist Ashley Hood was so bored 50 days into lockdown in Melbourne that she started analyzing the bits of rock in her home's tile floor.
I was in the unfortunate position of having 6 field trips cancelled in 2020, and I was going a bit mad, I think.
She posted her observations on Twitter.
The 2020 lockdown field guide to the geology of my house, the thread.
In one tweet, she posted a photo of grey tile with oval deposits and explained they likely formed on a seafloor.
They might have been a bit slimy, washing around in the waves. Please take me to find some more in the Bahamas or Bermuda.
Hood studies how ancient environmental conditions affected the evolution of life. She finally gathered rocks in the wild again on a trip to Central Australia back in January. But Victoria, where she lives, just entered a new COVID lockdown. And now Hood is pregnant with her first child.
And I know that, you know, as soon as we have a kid, it's going to be much more difficult to go to the remote mountains of Canada or, you know, Central Australia or Africa or places like this.
Layer professional logistics onto the personal, and fieldwork gets even more complicated. Research trips to hard-to-reach places like the Arctic and Antarctic can take years to plan, and they continue to be disrupted by the pandemic even as some more accessible research starts up again. In Greenland, an international project that's been studying the melting northeast Greenland ice sheet is cancelled for a second season this summer.
Normally we would go towards Greenland in late April.
Danish scientist Hilla Astrid Kær says a rotating crew of about 35 international scientists and staff fly to a field camp on the glacier on special planes fitted with skis.
And from there, we basically camp at the northeast Greenland ice stream.
It wasn't clear if the special planes would be available this year. And the team didn't want to bring COVID to Greenland, which has recorded only about 40 cases so far.
The risk is, of course, that the infrastructure has now been standing on the ice sheet with nobody to maintain it for two years. And this means that our things are basically getting buried.
Buried by snow. Aerial photos show snowdrifts nearly reach the roofs of garage and cargo tents at the field camp. Wooden stakes stuck into the ice to measure snow accumulation might in fact be completely covered by next summer. That could ruin 2 years of measurements. The underground snow caves the team works in while drilling into the ice are starting to collapse under the weight of accumulating snow. Visits from polar bears are another concern, Kerr says.
There is the risk that a window gets broken either by wind or polar bears or something else, and then everything snows within the building or the tent.
On the very bottom of the Earth, science teams at the US, UK, and Australian Antarctic research bases were significantly reduced this year.
So in a typical year, we have 31 people deploy to Antarctica. And in the 2021 season, we had nobody deploy.
Michael Gusev is the lead scientist for a project that's been taking the same measurements at streams, glaciers, soils, and lakes in one Antarctic region since 1993.
For the most part, these are all uninterrupted until the pandemic.
Almost none of that data was collected in the last field season. That includes observations that help Gusev and his team understand how climate change is impacting the region.
Without those measurements, we don't quite know how the glacier is responding. So when we start to look at time series, I think one of the fears that we have is whenever we put a time on the x-axis and try to look at how something changes, we now have a new gap.
The professional toll of this interruption is hitting graduate students the hardest. They have a limited window of time and funding to gather data for their dissertation research. Elizabeth Case is a PhD student at Columbia University who planned on using radar to study a glacier in West Antarctica for two field seasons. Now she doesn't think she'll go at all.
It was like definitely a whole morning process. Just the excitement and the like wildness of being able to go to a place like Antarctica. That was a huge reason I joined glaciology.
Case is now using archival data and modeling so she can still complete her research, and she started working on new diversity efforts in her field.
It took a lot of sort of like reflection to get to a place where I was like okay with refactoring my dissertation and seeing sort of the bright side. But yeah, I mean, I really do hope that I get to go to Antarctica one day. It would be definitely a dream come true.
It's not clear yet how the pandemic will impact science and a generation of young scientists in the long term, but they've already started to study how our slowdown during the pandemic is impacting planet Earth. They're calling it the anthropause. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Let's face it, keeping track of all the different coronavirus variants can be hard. Technical names like B1351 or B1617 are a mouthful. So it's not surprising that shorthand has taken over based on where variants were first identified.
To the new COVID-19 Brazilian variant.
Is the variant from the UK.
The Indian variant.
The World Health Organization now wants everyone to say goodbye to those geographic identifiers for the new variants and say hello to the Greek alphabet.
Things like alpha, beta, delta, certainly theta, eta, iota, gamma.
That's Emma Hodcroft, an epidemiologist at the University of Bern in Switzerland. She was part of the group that developed this new system.
In particular, we wanted something that didn't have too many existing connotations.
They debated made-up names.
So just as some examples were things like Pomenicus, Alcanerva, Avicorian.
Nope. They also thought about numbers, variant 1, variant 2, 3, etc. But that's hard to keep track of. Another idea that got tossed around, doing something similar to storm systems.
Hurricane Harvey.
Hurricane Maria.
We are closely monitoring Hurricane Laura.
Hodcroft says the group thought these names were too culturally specific. So the Greek alphabet for coronavirus variants, it is. Interestingly, the World Meteorological Organization recently dropped Greek letters for storm names. And that's a whole other story. With the coronavirus, it felt right because Greek is used around the world in science, math, and physics.
And so it has become a little bit more of a global alphabet.
Now, switching from the UK variant to alpha or going from the South Africa variant to beta, that's going to take some getting used to. But Hodcroft says it's an important change because it avoids stigmatizing communities and entire nations.
Unfortunately, if you don't come from these places and your only association is a deadly virus, then you're going to have negative ideas, and that can be really harmful.
A basic lesson we all learned on the playground. Words matter. And with that, we say goodbye on this Tuesday. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You be safe. Stay strong. See you tomorrow.